Hi everyone, and I'm a technology researcher, philosopher, and a lot on security researcher as well. I'm concerned a lot with topics surrounding cybersecurity and hacking and stuff like that. And as a technology researcher, I've also investigated a lot into utopian theory, because that is a hot new. And it's not me, huh? That's a hot new topic in technology research, kind of, because they've been putting up this hypothesis that actually the grand social utopias of the past are gone, like the grand anarchist utopias or grand socialist. Okay, experiencing technical difficulties. Yeah, okay, now. And we've been busy with utopias for a while in technology research, because this hypothesis has been coming out that there was this grand disappointment in utopian ideas with the decline of the USSR, and where everybody was sort of disillusioned about the power of utopian ideas, and the impact of utopian ideas all turned out in a very bad way, these grand social utopias. So. There was sort of a quiet phase for a while on utopias, where no real new utopias came up. But now actually we see some sort of a renaissance of utopian ideas in a lot of different shapes and disguises. And that's the thing we're interested in technology research, because a lot of these utopians are new utopians, which are quite small. And I'm going to say a bit about that, about the shapes in which they appear now. Because quite a few of them are very heavily technology related again, which is something which we have witnessed already during the first phase of the industrialization, where the first heavily technology laden utopias came up. And so this is something which we witness at the moment, and it's interesting from our perspective as technology researchers and technology philosophers, because these utopian ideas and these processes, of course, guides our sort of societal development alongside of technology and technological development as well. So that's an interesting topic for us. I've actually just published a book on that. It's in German, on Neue Utopien, which kind of tackles the topic from a variety of perspectives. Interdisciplinary book, maybe, if you want to look into it. So, and in this book, I did a little research on potential hacker utopian ideas, and that is something I'm going to talk about. And I think there is also some bearing on actual current politics as well, from this utopian kind of perspective, and I'm going to talk about that as well. So I'm going to, this is the outline which I have outlined. First, I'm going to give you a little introduction on utopias. Then I'm going to talk about what a hacker's utopia could be like, or what the utopian ideas in hacking have been. And then I'm going to talk about their application in current politics, and why that is a bit difficult from my perspective. And then I'm going to draw up some conclusions. Okay, so utopian ideas are stem from human desires. Just from a very basic perspective, we have a lot of desires, and we want a lot of things, and it's difficult, all the stuff we want, and there are some things we can change, and that's the whole area of human drama, you know, like love and sex and death and all this stuff. Although there are some utopian ideas now with transhumanism who are trying to transcend death, so that's an interesting thing, where things are actually shifted from the things we can change to things we can change. But then, of course, there's this huge thing, this huge chunk of things which we actually can change. And those are, of course, very inspiring for utopians, because... that's the wrong heading. Never mind. Those humans. Because a lot of the things we want actually are quite dependent on the social organization we have, or in some sort of technological advances. Like if you consider the grand utopian ideas we had in the past, like in the grand socialist utopian ideas as well, They were sort of reconsidering the social organization and how things could change if we would just organize distribution patterns a little differently, apply different principles of justice, not this the principle we have now, the principle of Leistung. What's that in English? Sorry, it's a bit late for me.
Performance.
Of performance, yeah, and more the principle of egalitarian distribution. And so that's one thing we can change, the social organization. And then, of course, there's the technological aspect, which we can change as well. We can do a lot with technologies, and I already mentioned industrialization, and that has had a huge potential to change things, actually, because the industrialization promised back in the 19th century that it would actually resolve all of humans' problems, like the need for food and need for shelter and the need for work. And the utopian ideas which came up with these new technology, production technologies, we're all like we would free humans from all sorts of needs and problems because we can provide them with all the basic things they need, and then they're free to organize in any way they want. So that there's a clear impact of technology here. And of course, these two things, social organization and technological advances, interact very intensely. So, and with this experience of change, which was actually made during the phases of industrialization or in other phases, and the first systematic experience of that was actually with the advent of modern science, and with that's the time where we see the first advent of systematic utopian ideas as well, like Francis Bacon's new utopian idea, the New Atlantis, and a couple of other more systematic utopian thinkers who were trying to explore actually these connections between society and technology and what could happen if we would change social society a bit like this and technology a bit like this, and then probably we could all live together in peace and prosper and stuff like that. So that was an experience which was made during that time and which was re-intensified during industrialization. So this was actually something which allowed the emergence of utopian ideas, because once you got this experience that you can actually change things by the use of technology, by systematic thinking, by also tackling society in a technological way, you know, like look at which societal institutions have which functions and how do they interact, and what happens when I twitch a bit here and a bit there, then you can actually change things. So that was really like the first advent of these grand utopian ideas. And so that's basically the outset of utopian theory. Like a utopia tries to consider some sort of the golden age. That's one very common metaphor. Another metaphor is also the good human. You know, you're trying to conceptualize a society by means of social structuring and technological structuring, and try to find a society and a way to live which is maximally desirable and maximally allows you to live your desires and to live in a maximally human way. And that's something which structures utopian ideas from that time until now, actually. And within the research we did in social theory and in philosophy, a lot of that was on the functions of utopian ideas. Of course, philosophers used to develop utopias as well. Francis Bacon was a philosopher, and he did some utopias. But what we're more interested in is the social functions which utopian ideas actually have. And of course, we can say some straightforward functions. They inspire the political agenda, they inspire change, and of course, they inspire technological design as well. But one very important function, which has always been stressed in by utopian theory, was that actually by designing a utopian society, you also create some sort of comparable society, which some sort of society which is comparable to the current society and which kind of criticizes the current society, because it says, well, people, we got this technology and we got this sort of social arrangements, but they can all be changed and they can all be altered. And if we would alter it a little bit like this and a little bit like that, then we would have a good society, even a perfect society. So that was also a way to criticize actual and current social ideologies and social organizations. And Yeah, I'm going to say a bit about the variants of utopias we have. Of course, we have the two basic type two basic types, utopias and dystopias, which is still a very important distinction to now. Actually, in current times, we see a lot of dystopian advances, dystopian ideas, especially in movies, like Matrix, for instance, is a dystopian idea as well. 1984 is a dystopian idea, and they are both equally important, as they both sort of criticize and point to certain patterns of organization and technological advances. But they differ, of course, in what they want to say. Utopia is always the maximally desirable society, and dystopia is always the maximally undesirable society. So that is one basic distinction. Another distinction, which is very important in utopian theory, is that between utopias and ideology. There's always been a debate on whether there actually is a difference between those two and what the difference could be, if ideology is always also utopian or utopias are always some sort of ideology. But generally, the distinction which is sort of accepted by now is that the utopian idea is always the inconceivable, whereas the ideology is something which is conceivable. Ideology proposes a state of society which can actually be reached by current steps and concrete paths which we can consider now, whereas the utopian society, utopian ideas were so far out, or considered so far out and unfeasible, that they're actually not reachable. And that's also within the word of utopia, because it says utopia is a place and you says non. So utopia is sort of the place without a place. That's the general idea they have. It's an idea which doesn't have a place. And the classical utopias, which came up in the 19th century, are all in the formal design, they're all placed on islands, remote islands. And that's always an example on why they how removed they are actually from the current place and society we're in. So that's the idea. There's no path to realize it, actually. It's just a fundamental critique of the existing state. And they're also often critical towards ideologies. Some utopian thinkers have always been saying that ideologies actually only serve to cover up some current social problems, like socialist ideologies, for instance, used to cover up a lot of existing problems in socialist societies and socialist dictatorships by always mentioning the good state, which is then to appear in some years, or the good human society, which we'll have in a couple of years, and stuff like that. So utopian thinkers used to criticize that a lot, and actually then reflected on ideology. Ideology, on the other hand, is always like some sort of a feasible extrapolation of existing states. It says, we have this state now, and we can do concrete things, we can develop this particular technology, or we can change this particular societal pattern, and then we are in the utopian society, right? So that's a very much more concrete way. They could say, we have this concrete path to follow. So it's only a partial critique of the existing state. It says only particular things have to be changed. And ideologies are also always striving for an actual change, and they always follow a political agenda. Sometimes, of course, they serve as a justification for some sort of bargains, as in socialist ideology, but sometimes they also follow their own genuine utopian agenda. So another basic distinction which you can make between utopias are whether they're more technology oriented or more socially oriented. When you have this technology orientation, then technology is like the big thing, and then the social order will somewhat follow up. Of course, both are very intimately connected, and you can't think the one without the other, but you can put a different perspective to things. So with technology orientation, then there's always some sort of utopian technology at the core. And a lot of these utopian ideas which developed during industrialization were heavily technology oriented. They said we have this and that technology, and then the society will automatically be good and in a perfect state and a utopian society if we have this technology. So society is considered as either stable and not altered, or just slightly altered in those utopian ideas, or it's just completely out of focus. Of course, these technology-oriented utopian ideas are often technology-deterministic as well. And that's a thing why a lot of engineers have actually been proposing these technology oriented utopian ideas. And that is precisely the attitude I mentioned, that that you think you devise up some sort of technology, and then once you got the technology, society will automatically change by having to use this technology into the good society. Of course, that's a very wacky idea somehow, and very short-sighted in most cases, because society also has a lot of uses for technology and constantly alters technology. So you can never actually expect society to be changed just by the introduction of some sort of particular technology. This is also a sort of utopian idea which we find now very frequently. We have these in many shapes, like Leitbilder is one thing we have in German science a lot. They give out some sort of general idea what a technological branch should develop into, or they have some technological visions, which are of course very important also for stocks and ideas like that. And many say actually that the current transhumanist agenda is more or less some sort of marketing gag to propose some sort of utopian ideas to sell all the nano stuff they're developing, or sell all the biotechnology they're developing. So that's one thing where we find these technology-oriented and heavily technology-deterministic utopian ideas. Another thing is the technological promise, which I already mentioned from industrialization, and there where they were actually saying if we perfectionize the process of production technology and production industry, then automatically the humankind will develop into something better, and they don't have to work anymore, there will be no need. And actually there's very interesting, I haven't been investigating in this very systematically, but there's an interesting sort of disillusion going on with this technological promise from the era of industrialization, because we are actually in that state now. We have this state in a number of theories. Post-materialism, for instance, one theory which proposes that we're actually in this particular state where production industry has the potential to provide us with everything we need, with all the basic stuff we need. So we have actually reached that state, but the good human society, the good human person, or the perfect utopian society where nobody needs to work anymore and everybody's free to do and follow whatever he or she wants to, did not develop from it. You know, quite the contrary, actually. We are very, very concerned with the jobs we are losing due to this industrialization process, which is actually more or less running as planned, but everybody's unhappy with it. So that's sort of a strange outcome of the technological promise, which was started about 150 years ago. And another idea, of course, is science fiction. Science fiction is also heavily technology-oriented and proposes a lot of ideas from within technology, how society can actually develop, in which shapes, and stuff like that. The other orientation, of course, is quite the contrary, or the exact opposite, the social orientation. And within this particular perspective, you take the social order to be the primary factor. You have to reorganize society, and then probably you need some sort of technology to reorganize it in that way, but technology is actually just a minor factor. So here in this orientation, the utopian social order is actually at the core, and technology has the role which the social order had previously, that it's either stable or just slightly altered or out of focus somehow. And technology, the interesting point about this sort of orientation within utopian thinking is that technology here is not meant to be deterministic or determining the patterns of social development, but rather to be highly malleable. It's like the technology can always be altered in the way we need it and be changed in the way we need it. And this is also a very classic position. You will find it with Marx, for instance, in the famous chapter 13 of the Kapital, where he has been concerned with technology. It's a famous chapter for philosophers of technology anyway, where he's been saying that if we need the socialist society, and if the socialist society should develop naturally, then we need to alter technology in this and that way, and we need these big centralized industries and production industries in this and that way. And so that was actually sort of a paradigm case of this utopian social order idea. Okay, and then one last distinction is between global and the local utopian ideas, which is particularly important in our times. Back in the old days, with the first utopian thoughts we had, the utopian ideas were really global. They were encompassing the whole of humankind, and the whole way we live used to be should be changed. So really everything, every aspect of life, every desire should be fulfilled, and everything should be good. And that used to be the primary idea, and the what a lot of the utopian thinkers back in the old days were following. And that's quite contrary to what we're witnessing now in the with the new utopian ideas, because many of those are quite local. They are not focused on the whole of humanity or the whole of human desires, but rather on rather particular desires, or on rather particular technological branches and particular ideas, and to develop them. So they do not encompass the whole of humankind or the whole of human problems, but just very particular questions. Okay, so this has been a short introduction on this new utopian research which we're doing. And now I'm just trying to mention some utopian impact within hacker thinking. So hackers have actually repeatedly provided utopian ideas, or had utopian ideas in the back of their heads, which then came out in some sort of technological developments or some sort of books every once in a while, or writings. Of course, these utopian ideas have been intimately tied to information and communication technologies very closely, so they are traditionally technology-oriented in a way. And the interesting thing about the hackers' utopian ideas were that is now that they've actually been changing over the last years due to the rise of information technology. Information technology back in the 50s, 60s used to be a very particular technology just for a very particular use, and but it now grew into a huge societal phenomenon. So actually the first utopian ideas, which were back then back in the heads of a few hackers, had a chance to develop into some huge actual societal change and societal ideas, because whatever you were thinking you could do with information technologies, which was probably completely meaningless in the 50s because nobody had a computer, is now an idea which you can extend on a large scale and actually imply onto society. So that's an interesting thing to look at from a researcher's perspective, because you can see just how the utopian ideas have been growing alongside the growth of information technology. So this is basically what I've been trying to look at a little, and I've been trying to follow the utopian ideas according to the social diffusion and the ensuing potential for technological development and or social change within information technology. And there are basically four stages, I believe, which you can discern. Stage one is the stage of some sort of proto form of a utopian idea, which is not really yet utopian, and it's very local, it's very technology oriented. You can place it back in the 50s, 60s, and you can pinpoint it actually down to the story of the Tech Model Railroad Club at the MIT, and the emergence of the hacker ethic, which was outlined by Stephen Levy. It wasn't that much of an explicit process anyway. Levy interpreted it into this group later. But the hacker ethic is some sort of a utopian perspective on how to handle information technology and what you could do with information technology and how you could live with information technology. So it was some sort of proto-form of a local little utopian thing there, like this ideas we have, the paragraphs we have a utopian sounding to them, like information should be free, or the current version information must be free, computers can change the world for the better, or distrust authority. These were all things which emerged very closely to the working conditions actually back in the 50s, 60s, and in this particular group of the Tech Model Railroad Club. I don't know if you've read the story from Levy, but they were actually very intimately tied to the working conditions which the group was confronted with. Like they didn't have access to any sort of information they needed to develop computers, so that was the first point where they said, well, information should be free, I should have access to all sort of scientific information about computers. And they weren't allowed by the professors and the authorities in the lab to play and meddle around with the computers, so they said, well, you got to distrust authorities, that's not a very, very good thing when you're trying to research and when you're trying to develop stuff. And of course, they had the perspectives from themselves, because they enjoyed computers a lot, that computers can actually change the world for the better. So that was sort of a very personal, very intimate, and very local idea which evolved back in those days. But it had this utopian extension, because if everyone was like us, and if everyone could enjoy computers that much as we did, which was the thought of these of the first group back then a world in line with the hacker ethic would just be a great place. And so that was some sort of a diffuse utopian extension, which developed back there. But of course, the group back then didn't have a clue what that could look like. Like, computers were huge and hugely expensive, and there wasn't any sort of idea how computers could actually be small and diffused throughout society, and what use they could actually have for that. So that was still a very diffuse and not very broad first idea which developed back in that stage. So stage two is actually then a longer period from the 60s to the 80s. It's a phase where we can see that the hacker's utopia is actually sort of materializing, growing stronger and growing more profound and more richer, because some basic technologies come up, the PCs come up, and some first networks come up, and first ideas on how things could be networked and meshed into each other, and some other ideas on how you could use computers for a variety of uses, not just scientific calculations and stuff like that. And then these first technological trends were extrapolated then by the hackers back then and by the scientists working with computers back then onto a societal scale. They were saying basically, well, if computers get smaller and cheaper, then why shouldn't they get very small and very cheap, and everybody should have a computer? And if you can apply computers actually to a number of uses and not just scientific calculations, why shouldn't you be able to apply it to any sort of use? And then there was also the same idea with networking. If I can network just a few computers, like in the ARPANET, why shouldn't I network all the computers and have access to a lot of information, do a lot of research, do a lot of development? So those were like first developments which allowed a more substantial extension of utopian thought. So the large-scale societal diffusion of computers and of networks seemed principally possible. It didn't seem very real back then, because it was still very expensive and still a very exclusive use and an exclusive group which did all these things. There was no sort of ideology to develop, but a more rich utopian idea certainly developed. And we can see this in a couple of mentioning a couple of technologies developing. For instance, Ted Nelson had the idea of the internet, 1965, 4 years before the emergence of ARPANET, and he published it in 1975 in his book. And a couple of other ideas like that come up as well, where people have actually been thinking about what could happen and what society could develop from these basic technologies. And these ideas, of course, interacted very intimately with technical research and development. So Ted Nelson, for instance, developed the hypertext because he was convinced of his utopian idea of the internet, that the internet would come up someday, and so he thought, well, if it comes up one day, then the hypertext is a good thing we should have, and I'm going to develop this now and sort of produce and try to help my utopian idea to develop and to come onto into a more realistic thing. Okay, so stage three then slowly developed. That's a stage of local ideology. It's still local, but it becomes more not only technology-oriented, but also social-oriented. Actually, it comes from the 80s up to now. And this is the phase where we see the real large-scale distribution of computers and the internet for a number of users, connecting all people, and an explosion, really, of users and of users as well. So So that, of course, gave a substantial impact for utopian thinking for these people who were concerned with the spread of the internet and with the development of new social ideas coming with it. And, of course, then over the years, the technology more and more existed. It was already there. The internet was there. The computer was there. And actually now, over the past years, everybody has a computer and everybody has the internet. So it's not anymore that we have to be so technology-oriented if we wanted to propose some utopian ideas, but we can rather turn to the social organization. We have to talk about the conditions of use. So if we want to realize the free information society and stuff like that, ideas like that. So the social aspect comes much more into focus than the technical aspect. And actually what we see is that there are some battles of use ideologies coming up, which are trying to figure out which way you could use the internet and how to keep it actually in this utopian vision, to keep it free and free from authority and keep information free, use it for research and development, stuff like that. And so the freedom of information technology related information became sort of a political agenda. And this is of course the stage at which ideology is reached, because now we can say we have we already have a basic outset of technologies, and now we need a clear path to develop these and a clear idea to develop these into this and this particular shape, and then we will be able to reach this utopian idea we have. So this is actually something which can be witnessed, and of course a very strong movement in this particular concern is the open source movement, which was concerned with the freedom of information within information technology and research and development. And that, of course, was they developed the ideology, the open source ideology, as a concrete plan on how to change and how to use certain social patterns like the GPL, GNU, to actually produce that change which leads to a utopian or a more utopian society. Linux was a technical development helping in that. And, of course, another movement is the anti-surveillance movement, which grew up during that time basically as well and is now pretty big, and which is also concerned with the freedom of information. Of course, with the anti-surveillance movement, not actually the utopian idea of the free information society is very determining, but rather the dystopian idea of the entirely unfree information society, which was sketched out by 1984. I'm going to say a bit about that a bit later. And that movement as well developed an ideology and as well developed concrete, clear paths and ideas on what you could do or how you have to use the internet, how you have to design the internet, which conditions have to exist for its use to make it into, to push it into the utopian direction and away from the dystopian potential it has. And the anti-surveillance movement then used a couple of lawsuits as well and developed anonymizers as well, a pretty good privacy and stuff like that, which were basically social and technological moves to push this agenda in an ideological way towards the utopian idea. And a very new stage, I believe, can be witnessed now as of late, just a very new phenomenon, and it's not really materializing that good as well. But we can also see that the idea of social utopia comes up as well, and some sort of globalizing ideology which extends from the pure local technology context of information communication technology. Like one thing of globalizing ideology is when you extend the idea of the freedom of information from the idea of the freedom of information technical information to the idea of the freedom of any sort of information. And when you deal with patenting of animals, for instance, then that is a clear case where you've extended that idea of information into a general idea of information, not just the research and development information for technology, information communication technology should be free, but any sort of information, any sort of knowledge, file sharing debate. Also a good example, any sort of potential knowledge should be free and liberated and so on. So the ideology is actually globalizing. It's growing from this small local compound where it has emerged first into a more global component. And we also see some first social utopian ideas, like Equinox, for example, and some other utopian thinkers are trying to use this sort of utopian extrapolation. Well, information and communication technology is everywhere in society now, and probably if I change that, then society can be changed. Okay. Society can be changed in a very substantial way, and probably if I can think about how to rearrange the social order now in order to come to this utopian thing which I have in the back of my mind. So we can see now some first advances where the hacker community proposes new utopian ideas, some sort of free information society with more democracy, freedom from capitalism, censorship, dictators, and other menaces. These are all ideas which are coming up now in a very substantial way, and a couple of initiatives, variants, and so on. And you're done now? Okay. It's not good to give the last talk on the day to try and play around. And okay, and and in many of these utopian visions, the technology stays fixed because there's not very much to change anymore. Everybody has the internet, everybody has computers, and the changes which we're striving for are social now. They concern the conditions of use and the social order within which the technology is embedded. So they are sort of developing social utopias. Okay, and how's my timing? I think I'm pretty quick. What time is it? 15 minutes. Okay, oh, that's okay. Okay, now the last part of my talk, I think that this development of utopian ideas and this parallel development of social order, new ideas on social order and new ideas on technologies is an important thing to consider now at the current times, because I believe, and I very firmly believe, that the information society actually is a very dangerous place. And 1984 is a very substantial dystopian idea, because what it did in 1984 was just to combine two aspects. It was only two aspects in 1984. The one is totalitarianism, which is a phenomenon which reappears in... It's a bit distracting. It's a bit blinking lights here, huh? Totalitarianism is actually is a very common phenomenon. We have a lot of writing about that, a lot of drama about it. But the thing which distinguished 1984 from other dystopian dramas or from other dramas dealing with totalitarianism was the use of and the embedding of information technology. You know, information technology was everywhere. And so that gave the particular impact for this novel, 1984, and for the particular dystopian vision. And I think that that is the immense danger, because if we're now in this stage where everybody has information and communication technology around him or her, then this aspect of 1984 with the information technology, which is able to surveil everyone and in every particular moment of his life, that's a part of this novel which got true already. You know, only the totalitarianism part is missing, but the problem with the totalitarianism part is that we do not have a solid recipe to prevent totalitarianism in the future. So if we have this sort of information technology which was devised in 1984, and a totalitarian dictatorship will come up at some point, and it will eventually happen, because we cannot prevent this. That's something that happens every once in a while in society, and we do not have a recipe, so it's likely that's going to happen again, despite Americans tend not to believe in that, but it might appear. And then we're actually immediately in this dystopian situation of 1984, because any new dictator which will come up will be ultimately capable to surveil us, each and every one of us, in each and every aspect of our life. So that's a very dangerous thing. And political activism with a clear agenda addressing this dystopian part is a very important thing to have at the moment, because this current design of information technology needs to be revised and needs to be covered very closely, so we do not get into this whole surveillance problem. And so while we're now entering in this, in the middle of this stage three thing, where we're developing ideologies and even entering stage four, where we're about to develop social utopias and some globalizing ideologies concerning the freedom of any sort of information, then the development of ideologies and of new social utopias need a lot of care, because there's a lot of responsibility attached to this. And in this particular stage, I believe we have to ask ourselves what could be a genuine and good agenda to follow from within the hacker utopian ideas and from within the hacker ethic. I think there is a genuine agenda when you consider the free information society, like any sort of to keep any sort of free information free. That's addressing societal problems related to the freedom of knowledge or to the potentials of techno-authoritarian suppression. That's very much in line with the hacker ethic, actually, the freedom of information and to distrust authorities and to be aware of the misuse of technology which can be which can happen from by their use of authorities. And this can be extended to cases where it's not even information communication technology related. And we have a couple of good examples, of course, already mentioned the anti-surveillance movement, the open source movement, the anti-censorship debate is very meaningful, very important as well. The Read-Write Society idea by Lessig is also an important issue to debate, and the digital divide problem, of course, concerns is much about this as well. It's about the freedom of information and the maintenance of democracy in third world countries. And the discussion on patents is meaningful as well in this particular case, because you can apply that to the freedom of information as well. So that's a very genuine agenda to follow here and to be active in a utopian way about. But another thing which I believe is a bit more problematic, and that's my personal taste. I mean, a lot of people will disagree with that, but from my personal point of view, is that sort of idea of a free informatized society. You know, that all of a sudden hackers should be concerned with any sort of societal problems as soon as information communication technology are somewhat have something to do with that, you know, because that's, well, then you don't really know why, actually. You know, of course, information communication technology gets into a couple of different areas now and a couple of different political debates and political concerns now, but the question is, why should hackers, actually, considering the hacker ethic as the core agenda, be responsible for that? So it's a lot, I think that a lot of responsibility is rather superficial. And that not all ICT-based societal problems can actually be answered from within the hacker ethics, because it doesn't provide answers to a lot of questions which now come up with the huge diffusion of information communication culture. And the outcome here is some renewed socialist revolutionism, which is not bad from my personal perspective, because I come from that culture as well. It's anti-state and anti-capitalism, but it also opens up new questions and opens up new topics which are not entirely clear topics considered from within the hacker ethic and the hacker agenda, the original core agenda. The consequences are that it must not be bad in itself, but it blurs the agenda. So some debates have some sort of unclear connections to the core agenda, and some other debates actually turn out to be more or less left-wing or right-wing infopolitics and become more and more part of ordinary left or right-wing politics and do not provide a clear, genuine hacker agenda anymore. A case in point, I believe, from my personal point of view, is the politicization of illegal downloads, which has a lot of difficult things to it. You know, there are some very legitimate parts, is that the reform of property rights, which is, of course, a core concern of the hacker agenda. And there's also the debate on whether mainstream music and film should be considered to be knowledge. But some other problems are absolutely open and not answered at all. Like many arguments which are brought up in this discussion lack scientific rigor and any sort of proof. Everybody just hypothesizes about the artists or whatever the industry and how it works. But nobody really knows what's going on and if anybody's really heard or stuff like that. Then it's not entirely clear if there really is a case of knowledge with Saw 6 or with Christina Aguilera. I find that debatable, and unless that debate is not finished, I don't think that there is a clear point for the agenda. A third point also is that this is also clearly a free beer issue and not a free speech issue. If you remember the Stallman saying that the freedom of information thing is about free as in free speech and not as in free beer. But the whole politicization of illegal downloads is only about free beer and not about free speech. So that's sort of off the agenda from my point of view. And it also offers some inconsistencies with a couple of anti-surveillance arguments which are very heavily needed in the anti-surveillance movement. One thing, for instance, is that the file-sharing community proposes some sort of technological determinism. Now the technology is here and we have to use it, this is the new thing developing and we have to go by it and this is a storm and we can't do anything against it. But of course, that's not true. We don't want that to be true. We don't want that to be true with surveillance technology. If the surveillance guys come up and they say, well, we have all this new technology now, and we have to use it, and we have to make the best of it, then we say, no, you don't. Okay, but all of a sudden, file sharing is a different issue? I don't get it. So other things, of course, are that the democratic processes and the rule of law are two things which are very heavily stressed in the surveillance debate, where we say that the state has to comply to the democratic processes and the state has to comply to the rule of law. And we don't want them to just decide these surveillance things on themselves. But all of a sudden, with this file sharing thing, that's exactly what we're doing. We're undermining democratic processes, undermining the rule of law, and just applying some sort of right of resistance idea to do that. And that doesn't strike me as a very consistent thing. And the last point, of course, is that there are some detrimental real political consequences regarding surveillance and the freedom of the internet, because, of course, the industry is not out of moves. They have a clear option to react to this, and this option is surveillance of the internet, ultimate surveillance of the internet. So that's a clear outcome of this whole debate on file sharing, and that's pretty contrary to anything we want from the internet. We want that to be free, and so probably we should just do away with this file sharing politicization because it promotes the surveillance of the internet. Okay, but that's just my personal point of view, and I know a lot of you will disagree with this. And now just some few conclusions. So hacker utopian ideas have actually been fragmentary, have been purely local and technology oriented. Some political struggles which we're now facing that ensue genuinely, and they met public interests and thus are useful, reasonable, and representative, like the open source movement and the anti-surveillance movement. But any political agenda apart from those narrow contexts which we had has no definite direction from the hacker ethics and gets imported from other ideologies or improvised and even differs subculturally. We have this very strong neoliberal right-wing context in the US and the very strong socialist left-wing context in the European Union. So that's not very balanced. And some sort of, and a thing which is developing as well is that a neutral and clear info politics, which is neither left wing nor right wing, is missing, currently hampered. It used to be there for open source and it used to be there for anti-surveillance, but it's now blurred because it comes in, it's enmeshed with all this left wing and right wing ideas. So I think that the agenda needs to be clarified. I think there's some systematic thinking needs to be applied to that. The open questions need to be tackled. And as long as the agenda is not really clarified, we should be tolerant towards alternative agendas and allow democratic processes to decide between them and not just enforce them on society. And I don't think that we should actually tie everything in this very experimental stage with the new ideologies and new social utopian ideas into some sort of rigid, united, we stand agenda. So that's just some sort of kind of criticism I want to give into this current political movement we're having. And that's the end. Thank you. Any questions?
That's okay. We still have time for questions. There's a microphone back there at the video desk. So if you have a question, please line up there, and so we don't have to repeat it.
Boo. Ah, okay. So yeah, I would like to give a comment and then ask for your thought on that. So I think that it's good. Sorry. I think it's good to see the dynamic of the appropriation, of the absorbing the progressive ideas. So in the history of art, like the museums were very smart to actually appropriate the critiques of the idea of museums, and very soon in the 20th century, the art just, if you were radical critique, you had better chances actually to get into the museums. And then also the corporations and the capitalism appropriated the ideas of the counterculture in the 60s, and probably the best symbol of that is Che Guevara on the t-shirt, which just became the very profitable good. And how I see the ideas and the utopian ideas of hackers, also got appropriated recently quite heavily. So for a very long time, the ideas of Richard Stallman that in the digital network it's very hard to keep the private property was recently got appropriated by Google mainly, so that they can actually really push the agenda, which was hackers' agenda. And if you see the latest document memo from Google, it's called The Meaning of Open. It's just recently, like 10 days ago, was there, and it's almost like a document which any hacker will sign, except the explanation of why they don't open the major technologies like search and advertisement. And also when it comes to the privacy, I think that Facebook is really appropriating the way how to articulate that. So they actually try to become the guardians of the privacy. And if you go and see how they try to solve the problem of that, they introduced the idea of some kind of Facebook government, and you have like document again Facebook values, which is some kind of constitution or something. It's very much in almost the articulation which any hacker would actually do, and of course that any hacker feels like, oh fuck, what the fuck is going on here, because Facebook and Google in that sense are not really the guys to do that. And there is also another appropriation which I see as very important, is by the Swedish whatever movement of piracy, which was really dealing with the hackers issues again through the avant-garde art. So there is a lot of ludism, there is a lot of playing the outlaw role. And I think that they did really good job in that. So it's very hard to appropriate piracy which they introduced. So in that sense, I'm trying to ask you, how do you see that mixture which is here? And again, also sorry, yeah, just Obama administration with their ICT policy, and Tim O'Reilly and the others, like, yeah, Eric Schmidt is now actually giving the vision of the great future of the society. So that's what's happening these days, and I think it's very excited and very tricky in many ways.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I agree that it's a very exciting phase we're actually in at the current moment, but we still have to see that a lot of these larger utopian ideas are still very much surrounded on information communication technologies, and thus they're not that big social utopias as yet. But one phenomenon which has very frequently been witnessed around utopian ideas was that the industry actually used utopian ideas as some sort of marketing. You know, when they saw that there was some sort of trend coming up, and that there was some sort of use trend coming up by also determining certain conditions of use by the users, like they want privacy or they want openness to experiment with that stuff. And they were just trying to go with the flow, you know, and trying to make goods out of it to sell them. In a way, that's sort of selling the ideas into the industry, you know, and feeding stuff into the industry, so it becomes changed, and you might be skeptical towards that particular kind of change. But in another way, I believe there are some good outcomes of that as well, you know, because in the end they promote openness, and in the end they promote privacy in a way. And so I think not everything that's being adopted by industry needs to be viewed in a skeptical way. So I think a lot of these local things which are happening now with the industry and with the politicians trying to implement some ideas of that are actually very good phenomena. You know, you just have to keep an eye on them so they don't try to just distract us and do something completely different. But as long as they stick to the rules and stick to what they're saying, I think that's a good thing.
My first question is for the audience, and by a show of hands, how many people here know a guy who maybe uses file sharing or thinks pirating is a good thing for society? Sorry. Okay, so we have right here a majority political party on a policy which maybe not everybody agrees with, or might be a distraction from other issues like counter-surveillance, and those are all important issues. But if we don't join a pirate party or something like that that represents what we all believe is right, then, you know, either we hang together or we hang separately. What do you propose to do other than work together?
Well, I don't think it's not really my kind of agenda, you know, the pirate party, because I think that it has a lot of inconsistencies in their debates, you know, and these inconsistencies need to be removed first. And one inconsistency, for instance, is how else do we pay artists, and how else do we which I mean, they're very interesting and good concepts and good ideas out there, like the cultural flat rate and stuff like that. But none of them seems to be very realistic, precisely because the scientific rigor and scientific studies are still missing. You don't know if you can actually implement these things. It's just some first ideas, and until you do know that you can implement these things and that you can change it, then you shouldn't be promoting some political agenda which is completely off the core agenda and which produces some counterintuitive results. So that's just, I'm not against it, you know. I mean, I'm an author and I publish books, and the books get sold for, like the Utopian book gets sold for 35 euros, and I get like €1 from this book, you know. I did 90% of the work, and also other books. I do 90% of the work, I get €1 for the book, and the book gets sold for 30 euros. So I'm the first guy to join any sort of copyright intellectual property reform, but... Pardon?
Who paid you to write it?
A university, mainly.
So the taxpayers
are not. Yeah. But still, I mean, some of the books are considered to be written in my private time and in my off time from the university, so it's not completely paid by the university. So anyway, I'm not against the whole thing, you know. The thing is, I'm quite in favor of a cultural flat rate and in favor of a reform of intellectual property rights, but I just don't see the relation to illegal downloads of Saw 6 and Christina Aguilera.
Can you speak to different lineages or technological development over the ages? For instance, the fact that hardware traditionally has been pursued along lines of power, and not necessarily capitalist power in its current permutation, but also before that, state power in general, and how we're seeing like a difference in the way that software, for instance, is developed, a more collaborative, democratic way that software is developed, because you don't necessarily have to have the means of production to produce
it. No, that's precisely the point. You don't have to have the production, you know. You don't need to produce semiconductors on your own, which is a very poisonous, dangerous process, very expensive. And so software is really free to be developed by everyone.
And also the way that, like, weaponry...
sorry?
The lineage of technological development has traditionally followed lines of weaponry, because that was what... change the balance of power and how. And even the internet, to some degree, is a product of the Cold War, the Cold War mentality and the hardware that originally developed. You know, you see, for instance, the fact that the new open culture is really more random development than anything. It developed because there was, hardware that was developed from a capitalist perspective, and then, because of sociological things.
Oh, that's clearly a good thing. I mean, one very important thing parallel which we have here is the atomic bomb, which was a major technology which could only be produced by major state actors, and that was actually a technology which determined world politics for some 30 years now, for the era of the Cold War. Actually, even longer, some 40 years, something like that. And of course, that is a clear case where power interests and authorities just play a very important role in designing the actual social order, because they have the power of the production of technology. And that is, and that of course is changed now with software, because everybody can produce software, and thus also the design of technologically oriented utopias is democratized in a way, and that's a very good thing. I'm getting out of words, so...
I have a question, or would like you to ask your opinion on it, because I think, like, one of the main questions that need to be answered within this hacker society is the question of what do we actually talk about if we talk of freedom, because as you mentioned, like in the US, there are these neoliberal right-wing hackers on the one side, and there are all kinds of other hackers on the other side, and they all talk of freedom. And there is a way of wording of freedom by the neoliberals saying, okay, you have the freedom to make money in a way, you know? That's their definition of freedom. The main thing is you have the freedom to invest and make money with that and more money with that, and that's supposed to be freedom. And on the other hand, you have a different definition of freedom that says freedom from the need to make money, for example.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very important point, actually.
The file sharing thing is going more into the direction of freeing people of the need to make money, to buy everything what they need. And so that's more the topic. And I think also someone mentioned the Pirate Party. For example, the Pirate Party has not answered this question yet.
Yeah, very good comment, actually. And that's very true as well. I mean, the problem with the neoliberal agenda we have in the United States, for instance, is that they're, of course, they mean primarily freedom of the market. You know, the neoliberal idea is that we can only have a free society if the markets are free. You know, that's sort of the hierarchic concept they have of freedom. The markets have to be free, and if the market is free, then the society will be free. So freeing the markets is like the first and foremost thing. And so one of the points on the agenda of many U.S. hackers is then, or the old school U.S. hackers like Barlow, is to keep the markets free and to keep the markets functioning. And so surveillance within to catch phishing or to catch credit card fraud is very important for them because it keeps the industry functioning, and they're completely okay with that. You know, they're completely okay to control the internet if it is only about credit card and if it is only controlled by private firms and not by the state. You know. And that's an idea which is completely different to what we have here. If we talk about the freedom of information and the freedom of knowledge, of course, we want it to be entirely free, democratic, and probably even anti-capitalism and not determined by the industry and by the needs of an industry. So that's a clear case of a conflict where these two ideologies actually come into conflict. And I think we will see a lot of these conflicts emerging in the future as well. So. That's a very important question. I don't have a definite answer yet, though.
Yes. I wanted to say I don't believe in capitalism as it's something that's so really clearly defined. And I would propose maybe some kind of solution for the... For the old problem of whether it's socialism or capitalism or anything, I think the main factor is monopolization of control and the use of force or violence. And in the case of piracy, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, you connect to another one's computer and load some files from there, and you have nothing to do with people who want to sue you or anything. And if they sue you, you will get a letter and you will get a nice visit or something, and they'll steal your computer or anything. I mean,
so what's the question?
Yes, I don't know. I mean, you can... Oh, fuck.
Okay, anyway, think about it, write me an email, I'll write you back. Okay, then, no more questions? I need a beer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sandro.